Putting pen to paper is a good first step, but starting a magazine takes more than mere words. Myths of doom and gloom aside, about 87% of adults here in the UK, for example, read magazines regularly, and all budding young publishing extraordinaires have at least one thing in common. They're all hungry for that very first issue that stands out from the rest. That's ahead today on The Stack. Coming up on The Stack, from big ideas to the practicalities of paper, we're taking a closer look at what makes an eye-catching debut.
I come across quite a lot of people that sort of describe a new project in the terms of, well, it's like X mixed with Y with a bit of a Z. You know, you have to be original, you have to come up with something more definitive.
Plus, sometimes it's not so much what you say, but how you say it. And for a magazine publisher, sometimes it all comes down to the paper.
In general, I think, certainly from the creative point of view, people actually probably valuing materials more than ever.
That's today on The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. We'll dive into the gritty details of paper stocks a little later in the programme. But first, Jeremy Leslie is a good friend of ours here on The Stack. His studio, Mag Culture, collaborates with clients across the US, Europe and Australia, developing new standards of editorial design. He has a multifaceted approach. There's the shop, there's all different kinds of angles. And I always like to just gauge how things are going generally, Jeremy. How are you right now? Do we find you well?
I am well. I am well, despite the kind of background of political news that we've been experiencing.
It's funny, we were laughing before the show started about... It is funny, it's not a political discussion programme, though it can be if we want. But it's funny, you know, a lot of people who certainly work in industries that we're interested in, independent publishing, the world of magazines, this sort of Brexit, the general situation in the country, does seem to kind of filter through to everything. Are you worried, just briefly on this, are you sort of worried about the... what the short and medium term future holds, or are you fairly sanguine about things?
Well, obviously, I mean, I was very depressed about the outcome itself. Mm. It does seem an absurd situation to be in. But that said, you have to. I mean, I haven't seen any direct results day to day in terms of what I'm doing yet.
That's good.
Exchange rates aside, I don't know. I'm more of an optimist than a pessimist, so I'm more inclined to think that it's going to work out somehow.
That's very much our house view, isn't it? Yeah. We're an optimistic bunch.
Absolutely.
So that's
absolutely
positive. Well, we're striking a sunny note to start with, which I think is very good. And actually, we're going to talk a bit today about sort of new beginnings and getting started. And that was a theme I wanted to pick up really about generally about getting started with magazines. Mm-hmm. Are there any secrets? Are there any shortcuts to getting started if you want to start publishing a magazine? Or is it always about
a lot of hard work? Yeah. If only there were. I mean, there's plenty of advice available. Certainly what I'm seeing at the moment is a huge interest in people wanting to start their magazines. You know, there's always this, you know, we've gone way beyond the idea, you know, that there are a lot of magazines being launched. I think we accept that, and then the sort of discussion is, well, maybe it's going to slow down. It doesn't show any sign of slowing down. People wanting to launch their magazines. I'm doing a lot of things, a lot of kind of academies and talks and various things geared towards helping people launch magazines. There is coming soon that Angered Lewis has written a fantastic book called So You Want to Publish a Magazine, which I'm sure will feed into that. There's a lot of advice in there.
That sounds like the kind of primer that's
absolutely it is, and it has a lot of good advice. Lots of interviews, including one with Tyler, the editor in chief here. It has a good broad selection of people and experts from the independent industry. But of course, in the end, you know, it can't be a kind of all you have to do is follow 1, 2, 3, 4, and hey, you've got a successful magazine. There's a lot more to it than that. And I think, my advice to start with would be, first of all, come up with something. Be sure you want to do a magazine. I mean, be certain there's a space and there's something to your idea that is unique. I think, you know, I come across quite a lot of people that sort of describe a new project in the terms of, well, it's like X mixed with Y with a bit of a Z, and this is going to be the new magazine. And that's not, you know, you have to be original. You have to come up with something more definitive than you know, of course, everyone looks at magazines, and there are reference points, and there are certain key magazines that you might refer to. But you can't. There's no point. It's a very, very hard thing to do, let alone be successful at. And so you have to be certain that you've got something that you can truly spend time and resource and effort to make a success.
And that's interesting, because that's not just about having a singular vision, I guess. It's about having an absolute passion for it, mm-hmm. and a passion for expressing it in that particular way. Because there's probably people who say, well, look, there's no one more passionate than me about, I don't know, design or some facet of design. So if I did a design magazine, it would be brilliant. And that's not it doesn't necessarily follow. You need to have a passion for the process, I guess, as much as for the end product.
To an extent, you can learn the process. I think it's more about the sort of having the character and personality that's going to translate into a magazine. Mm. You know, the idea has to have something which is more than just a design magazine. What's the, you know, that kind of falls into the kind of, well, it's a design magazine that's a bit like this. You have to, maybe it's not even a design magazine, but it happens to be about design. It's go beyond that. And then the other thing I always say to people is start small. You know, don't go in all, unless you've got some fantastic, huge, wealthy benefactor behind you.
That is a good shortcut,
which is a shortcut to be recommended. Yeah. But
that's interesting, because I guess people will probably maybe sometimes blur the boundaries between being ambitious and not wanting to show a lack of ambition by being modest with the initial.
But it's not about necessarily about being modest in intent. Insofar, I think if you've got limited resources and are very ambitious, you're far better putting those resources into making fewer of a very good magazine than sort of trying to do print thousands and stretching your budget too thin and weakening the individual copy. I think it's much better to go in with sort of even 500 copies that you've invested some effort in the terms of the content and the planning and then the production, and make them really beautiful so that first issue goes out to people and people are impressed. And of course, I mean, you know, all being well, 500 goes very quickly, and they're scarce, and so the kind of then when it comes to issue two, you can increase it and build it from there.
And interestingly, actually, there are some models, I guess, where it stays at that scarcity almost imbues the publication with value. The name of it escapes me. Our friends in Singapore, the family who make that incredible...
Ah, yes, Rubbish. Oh, Rubbish Fanzine.
Rubbish Fanzine, which I absolutely love.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that only ever...
Is 300.
300.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
That almost makes it more compelling,
yes,
and
absolutely.
You can't wait to see what's next. Yeah. And the idea that it's even hard to get hold of, you know, lends it an extra.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a case in point. I mean, the question with, I mean, that obviously is a project that's set out just to cover its costs, rather than be more ambitious in terms of scale and as a business in its own right. But nonetheless, yes, I mean, it's very, you know, they cover their costs. It's a handmade bespoke object.
And a very beautiful one at that, usually. What else have you got? Now, it's interesting because we're talking about getting started. And I know, as well as your our little primer that you were discussing there, which is a very beautiful thing, you have a first edition, I'm right in saying, of something which you seem rather enthusiastic about.
I'm highly enthusiastic about it.
Excellent. I mean, that's what we like. More optimism.
I mean, it's been interesting. I mean, you know, with the Mag Culture Shop, we've just passed 6 months, and the influx of new magazines shows no sign of abating. And I get very excited whenever there's a new magazine coming. But then sometimes there's a new magazine that's ticking even more boxes, and is even more exciting. Yucca arrived just earlier this week, and we featured it as Magazine of the Week on the Journal. And it's a fantastic magazine. It's fantastic. It's a food magazine, which, just in terms of what we're talking about, you know, launching a new magazine, it's about food. And there's an element of, great, another food magazine.
Yeah, how are they going to
do something
what's
that's different?
The USP?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So it's the first issue. It's from Barcelona, but it's English language. And it's a fantastic magazine. It takes food as its theme, or its alibi, which I really like. I mean, the themed magazine is a much worn trope, but they've come up with this term alibi, which is a far more intriguing way to describe something, a thread that runs through an issue of a magazine. And this first issue is all about the roots of food, and the sort of the signature piece maybe is a piece about the history of hummus and its relationship to both Palestine and Israel, and the, you know, who makes the best, etc. What I love about it, and then this perhaps goes into the advice about launching a new magazine is it needs to be kind of crystal clear what a magazine is about and when you launch it. And this magazine, it comes across quite clearly as being about food. But as you scratch the surface and get deeper and deeper into it, it gets more and more intriguing and more fascinating. So on the face of it, it's a food magazine. It's quite a simple proposition. But as you go deeper into it, you realise it's very, very eclectic and intriguing and different in its approach.
Many layers, like an onion, appropriately enough for a food magazine. Tell us a little bit about the sort of look and feel. Are there any sort of, I don't know, particular, whether it's, you know, creative flourishes, mm-hmm. things in the design or in typesetting? How would you summarise it for
our
audience?
It's certainly... it's well put together, it's well designed, it's not particularly necessarily revolutionary in its design, but I think where it does tick a huge box for me in terms of the general kind of approach to food magazines, I mean, take something like The Gourmand, a favourite of mine, and right up there in terms of production values, the fantastic food shoots, etc. And it does that. It's one of the best in that field. But there is a way of photographing food that's quite, you know, you're used to seeing beautiful shots of food and restaurant, etc. This has a lot of kind of more much more rough and ready kind of reportage-y type photography, which is a relief. That you're not going to see a beautifully laid out table with a tablecloth and a carefully styled dish in here. It's much rougher and ready about the life and culture of food. They have some fantastic diversions. There's a great visual piece about the logos of Spanish food companies, in particular pork products.
A variety of smiley cartoon
happy,
pigs are looking
happy
back at
pigs
me.
Offering offering a plate full of
they're
their
happy, they're
of
happy
their,
now
of their, their piglets products.
To a degree, are you sort of willing to overlook obvious pitfalls sometimes that first issues mm-hmm. fall into, on the basis that, you know, we know how easy it is to make mistakes and how hard it is to get everything right? And I guess that's maybe why you said this one really jumps out to you. Mm-hmm. Is it because it's so accomplished?
Yes.
as a first go?
I mean it's accomplished in every respect that I've just described, but it's also exciting because there's a there's a vibrancy to it, and as I say, there are layers to it which repay regular, you know, revisits. It's a very sophisticated editorial product, I think.
Fantastic.
And the best one in the world, not every magazine can achieve that first go. And I mean, we tend to, with Mag Culture, and when we're writing about them in the journal, we look at, as I said, I'm an optimist. We try to critique and offer constructive criticism, but largely we're highlighting the good stuff.
Yeah, well, that's a place where we're happy to operate as well, Jeremy. More from Jeremy Leslie, our good friend from Mag Culture, in the show coming up. Fenner Paper may be a slightly smaller player among the ranks of paper suppliers here in London, but that's perhaps part of the company's strengths as something of a bespoke purveyor. Justin Hobson is the man behind the company, and like any professional with a passion for his craft, his at times obsessive attention to detail doesn't switch off at home time. I spoke to Justin Hobson when he popped into Midori House earlier this week. Justin, good to have you with us here on The Stack. Let's start off with a bit of a scene setter, I suppose, if you like. How's life at Fenner Paper? What are the key things that are happening at the moment? Is it a challenging environment? How would you sum up where you're at right at the moment?
Well, we're a paper merchant, so we're basically buying paper from around the world, but more specifically Europe, and then distributing that in the UK. We've got various different sort of angles to our business, including working with creatives and on more sort of design-led sort of papers. Mm. Then we've got an area of business which is in the greeting card sort of side of things, which is also still creative, but, you know, requires a certain type of, you know, materials. And then more recently into the luxury packaging market. I've got a colleague that has joined us recently called Kerry McDonald. She's based up in Scotland and specifically deals with the sort of drinks sort of side of things. But yeah, I mean, effectively things are very good at the moment. You know, people are, in general, I think, certainly from the creative point of view, people actually probably valuing materials more than ever. Mm. I think that the days of maybe pile it high, sell it cheap, you know, type of stuff, and the commodity side of things, which obviously is still around and still very, very important because so much of the world relies on bits of paper. But certainly for those brands and industries which are actually looking to differentiate themselves. Mm. One of the ways of doing that, whether it's a piece of packaging or a piece of, you know, paper for literature, whether that's a cover or the inside text papers or whatever, that is actually being sort of looked at quite hard in a positive way, which is obviously good for us because that's a space that we
operate in. So is it more? It's clearly then it's less of a sort of a volume play, and it's more of a niche pitch, presumably. And it's interesting that you mentioned that idea about the sort of this luxury space, the high end sector. Is that really where you're seeing the potential for the most growth, at least in the short term?
Yeah, I mean, we've actually found ourselves in that space, possibly by a little bit of luck, probably more luck than judgment. That's because during the 1990s and in the 2000s, when the paper market in general was still on an ascendancy, and let's face it, our industry has been on the ascendancy ever since William Caxton in this country, because as printing has got bigger and bigger and bigger, obviously the paper side of things has needed to feed that side of the industry. And it's only been in recent times, and I'm talking literally within the last probably, well, certainly 10 years, that paper has stopped being the medium for mass communication in people's hands. Because, I mean, I think the iPhone only came out in, 2008?
I mean, it's extraordinary to see how quick that change has been. On that point, though, where's the pressure being brought to bear most? Is it that you're seeing, you know, mills closing? Is it that you're seeing, is it harder, you know, do clients come to you and you say, actually, I'm finding it more difficult to source the kind of uncoated stock that you're talking about because it's just not there anymore? Is that where the pressure point is?
I mean, the manufacturers have been closing, well, actually, ever since I started the industry, 30 years ago. But you know, obviously part of that is because they were not efficient, et cetera, rather than the market not being there. Nowadays, it is down to lack of demand for certain types of products. It's interesting because paper has obviously grown up over many, literally over centuries, to the various different types of paper. So you'll now find it quite hard to get specific types of paper for specific usage. So, and obviously I'm talking slightly out of where we inhabit as a company, but for instance, when I was growing up, Mars bars were wrapped in glassine. It was dark brown glassine paper, which you'll still find in your chocolate boxes these days, on top of chocolate. But that's how Mars bars came around. Well, when packaging started moving away from paper and into the sort of plastic side of the market of materials, then obviously a lot of those paper mills, obviously disappeared because the market wasn't there. And in fact, now I suspect that if suddenly Mars decided, right, we're going to go back to, paper, I doubt very much whether there would be capacity.
The provider.
Yeah. I mean, but, it is still made. As I say, you can still find it in chocolate boxes, but I just don't think that the capacity is there.
Is that the story? Is it more of a sort of a speciality? It's interesting, we talk about, we hear about highly specialised niche products. People say, well, can you find us some paper that's made out of, the algae that we'd find in the canals of Venice?
Absolutely, and this sort of thing. Yes, that's one of the ones.
Is that, if you like, the future maybe for where there are these pressure points where mills are maybe having to close down? Do people need to look into highly, highly specialised areas? Do you think is that a more profitable route forwards, perhaps?
Yes and no, but I mean, it's still important to make paper that actually people can use and actually want to use. And it's all very well making papers with nice stories, but if they actually don't stand up as products on their own, or rather in their own right, then they're not very valid. I mean, the Alga Carta, which you mentioned, which is quite an interesting case in point. There was a serious problem in Venice back in the 1990s. I think they were taking something like 60,000 tons of wet seaweed out a year out of the lagoon, and they had to take that out because otherwise it was going to clog up. And one of the problems was that they actually just didn't know what to do with it. If they just left it, it was festering and becoming very smelly. So it was one of many projects which were instituted to find a use for this thing, by actually milling it, by drying it and milling it, powdering it, turning it into an additive, into paper, it was a paper that was actually had a validity.
Justin Hobson from Fenner Paper. This is The Stack, and we'll have more from Jeremy Leslie on the way next.
Each week on The Foreign Desk, we take a look at a single story, we find two or three great guests, and then we try to work out what's going on. It might be the story that's dominating the news that week.
The main thing they wanted to do was to stop, to get rid of Obama. How are you going to negotiate with that?
It might be something we think everyone else is ignoring.
Children, elderly, it doesn't matter. Anybody that is leaving the country is going to be shot.
Either way, the format's the same. Guests who know their stuff, talking knowledgeably, so that you and me end up knowing a little bit more than we did before. That's The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, airing every Saturday at 12 noon London time and available at any time on monocle.com.
This is The Stack on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Still with me here in Studio One is Jeremy Leslie from Mag Culture. And Jeremy, we rattled through some advices for potential magazine debutantes. And we looked at a first edition that ticks, well, I don't know, pretty much all the boxes from the way we were describing it. You've got a couple of other titles, though, which would be good to chat about, too, on the programme. Where should we go next? What's this handsome, large volume you have?
Well, I brought along 212, which is published from Istanbul, partly because of its scale. And Yucca, which we were talking about previously, that's not small, but it's larger than a lot of independent magazines now. And there are sort of parameters around size to do with printing costs and postage costs that define that magazines, when they launch, tend to veer towards the smaller. 212, I know from personal experience with our shop, is a nightmare to post. It's as good as A3. I'm not sure it is quite A3. And it's a good 200 and something pages.
It's got some heft.
We've got a display in our window at the shop at the moment, and it is just big magazines. And there's Luncheon, 212, De Grief, which we'll come to. These are large format magazines, and it's very healthy to see such big items. 212 is fascinating because it's very much a kind of classic looking magazine. It's classic typography, fabulous photography. And it's just on the large scale, and it's satisfying. It's satisfying to see that.
I do love to see it. Again, it's a bit old school of me, but I do love to see a spread with a good, nice amount of white space, Jeremy. And I think that's a bit of a classic sort of design, motif. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, something about that being there, I find reassuring in a way.
Well, you know, it's classic. What is the word? I mean, it's like the word cliches. I mean, they are such because there's a reason.
Exactly. You know. So, Jeremy, let's delve specifically into 212 then. Any what's the real standout from this issue?
What's interesting about the magazine? I mean, it is from Turkey, but there are some more. There's some sort of generic content. The theme of this issue is strange days, and it does look at the kind of. I mean, this was published before Brexit, but it does look at the kind of strange political fault lines that are going through, changing our world today. This kind of conflict between globalism and localism. But there's a mix of. I mean, there's a great interview in there with Adam Curtis, who is always. Good copy as far
Definitely,
as I'm concerned,
yeah, yeah.
But not particularly related to Turkey. But there is a great photo story about traditional Turkey.
A full bleed image on a magazine of that size.
Yeah,
I mean, it jumps right out of you.
Absolutely,
doesn't it?
Absolutely. But it's behind Turkey. It's not the Turkey you see in the tourist brochures, and it's a small thing, but it's something. You know, I think it's great to see a magazine from a different area of the world trying to open up its own home.
Exactly. And what an inviting prospect that is in its large format. Now, you did mention De Grief just briefly. Let's delve into those pages.
So this is actually issue 9.
Very slightly more modest in size than 212.
Yes. It would be large in any other context. Following 212, it's relatively small. It's issue 9. It's a photography magazine from Germany. And I have a feeling it actually might be called De Grief rather than De Grief. But beautiful photography. As you were just saying, you know, photography placed on white background. The lovely little thing that they do, which just adds again another layer to the whole presentation and experience of it, is that they pick out little details from the pictures on the edges of the page.
Right.
So there's an image in there with some black paint or oil being poured over some hands, and then in the corner of the page, completely unrelated to the picture, there's a little black smear of oil. And so there's just it just this really neat little trick that adds something that makes the photography part of the magazine in a way that it wouldn't if it was just presented picture, picture, picture.
That's very clever. And I guess some people might say, you know, you're treading a delicate line there, getting, you don't want to get into sort of gimmickry or anything, but it's very, very, very finely and cleverly
But
done,
I think you
it?
Could easily flick through that and not notice it. Yeah. It's just a really subtle little drop of nice. Extra.
Yeah, there's a lovely shot here of somebody out in the sort of wilds, and there's just a little peep of a frond breaking
yes, exactly.
the edge of the
yeah, yeah,
page. Very, very clever. Very clever indeed. And again, it always strikes me with magazines of this character, it's like, you know, what is the model? We're obviously nine in. You know, there's clearly, I don't think there's any advertising in here. And I can't see what the cover price is. But it always, I marvel and it reassures me that we're seeing beautiful magazines and, you know, maybe there is a wealthy benefactor or maybe they're funded by something else. But it's just great that they're... It's just great that they're here, wherever they're, whatever their origin
well,
story
I,
is.
Yeah, I mean, I've come along to celebrate these fantastic magazines. I don't have the background on the finance side, but they seem to be existing. They seem to be surviving.
And isn't that enough? And our optimistic
I'm just happy,
take on the
I'm
world
happy
this week?
They are. Yeah, and I'm also very happy that in this post-Brexit world, I've come along with a Turkish magazine, a German magazine, a Spanish
Quite.
Magazine.
Here, here, Jeremy. We'll drink to that. Jeremy, what else is occupying you? What else is blowing through your transom at the moment?
Well, we've just celebrated our first 6 months of the Mag Culture Shop. That's all going well. We're having regular events there, but of course we're building up now to our annual conference in October. I've just come straight from a planning meeting for that. We've got some very exciting ideas coming together for the Modern magazine this year. We're back at CSM, got some great headline guests, Gail Bickler from the New York Times magazine, Christoph Amend from Zeit is coming over, the editor. We've got Penny Martin coming.
Fantastic.
And plenty of others yet to
TBC. So that's some pretty stellar names there. Yes. And some good friends of ours on the stack, of course, amongst that. Little,
absolutely. And then we're also planning some nice little things around that as well, which will become clearer the next few months.
Very exciting.
But it's going to be, as we try to make it bigger and better each year, and there's some nice little twists coming, I hope.
Excellent. And people can find more information
at magculture.com.
At magculture.com. And let's hope I'm sure we'll speak to you before then. It'd be good to get, get the latest in the preceding weeks. Jeremy, wonderful to see you, as always. Thanks
always
for sharing your
Thank
wisdom
you,
with us. It's our good friend Jeremy Leslie from Mag Culture joining us here on The Stack. And that is all we have time for on this week's programme. My thanks to our producers, Ben Ryland and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and to our editor, Toby Hammond. Comments or queries are welcome, as always, info@monocle.com. And don't forget to join us at the very same time next Saturday. You can listen again and find out more at monocle.com or catch the show or any of our others on your favoured platform. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you very much indeed for listening.